If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Grainger understands that you go to great lengths, and sometimes heights, to ensure the power is always flowing. Which is why you can count on Grainger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Winter, spring, summer, fall, seasons change, we still keep it together.
Hey, Beverly Hills 90210 fans, are you ready to dive deep? Episode by episode, storyline by storyline, character by character, as we break down the making of your favorite zip code with your host. Charles Rosen.
Did I say that?
Mary Mullen.
This thing about the real person, and we go, what? We're getting rid of this guy.
Pete Ferrero.
I'm feeling wonderful. Kathleen looks crush, TV crush worthy.
Like so many special guests and all your questions. Live on the Beverly Hills 90210 show. Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, here we are on another of the Beverly Hills 90210 show. Charles, you've been all over the place.
I've been everywhere, man.
Mainly Arizona, you were away, and we're sorry for all the scheduling. We wanted to do this Wednesday. It just wasn't possible. Your Wi-Fi wasn't wonderful. It was like 1992's Wi-Fi, right?
especially when you're up in these beautiful red mountains of Sedona, which is on the road to between Phoenix and the Grand Canyon, and I've been to the Grand Canyon a couple of times, and I think that Sedona's more the physicality elements of Sedona are more breathtaking and interesting. So, beautiful red mountains. I encourage anybody to go there.
You had a nice time, really. Just the Wi-Fi was not wonderful.
Well, you get up in those mountains, not so good Wi-Fi. I find the whole state of Arizona, well, how can I say it? It reminds me of Arizona. Arizona, although still in Arizona, let's call it like it is. They still one state. You know, Arizona has some challenging driving. It just does. You drive in LA, you see an Arizona plate, you got to be a little wary. But nothing. And in there it wasn't, even in Arizona, you'd be driving on the roads and this, and why is this driver doing this? Oh my gosh. And where's this driver from? Right. Hello, Florida. You know, they're
always. All right. Florida, I see our guests waiting in the wings, but I want to start with you to ask you about Highwire. A lot of things are happening in this episode. We're moving to a lot of different things. One of the things is the legacy key. And we'll talk about that in a second. But the other big thing that's happening here is there's a lot of a big debate about who's going to go to college. Brenda and Brandon have an issue with their parents not having the funds to send both of them away to school. This is the crux of this. So why don't we start here talking about the college debacle?
You bring up the moment or the thing that is absolutely most contrived, and in fact to an unbelievable length, quite frankly. We're going to think about it and we'll get back to you Friday, so you better stay here for all four acts of this TV show. And if you would have guessed right then, you may have come to the conclusion like that the kids who were squabbling about who had the right to go would both choose to stay in Los Angeles. And that after the parents, of course, have said, we'll take out a second mortgage without the parents going, we'll have to get into debt. And indeed the 90s were the period, because these were the children of the baby boomers, and there were more, you know, the Gen Z coming into the 90s. People were thinking about relative to college, and college expenses were going way up. So the cost of college, cost of private education was such that really was, you know, this was on families' minds. And as you and I have discussed, you know, what, you know, Mr. Spelling was uncomfortable with this episode. I think lots of reasons. I think the first one is because it was really clear now they're moving on. They're thinking about things that aren't just sis, boom, bah.
A commitment to college. This episode is not only a commitment for Brandon and Brenda, but also for Mr. Spelling that next season.
And even though the next episode that follows is in, you know, very high school, which is home and away. Right. It's the dance and a football game. And of course, with the twist of some of the violence that was going on in L.A. at the time. Unfortunately, then the more things change. Right.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think it was also knowing how he would think about things. I think that it was one thing to, you know, he liked to deal with things with money. He liked that. And he liked, wow, we have a lot of money, but he didn't like people to flaunt it. So there was Steve Sanders saying, I got the bucks. It's not going to matter. I don't have the bucks. It will matter. He didn't like thinking in these character terms of, you know, they're wealthy, they're not wealthy. In real life, he did kind of, but not in to show the money struggles that a family like the Walshes,
yes,
who are supposed to be in Beverly Hills, have some, even if it's the other side of the tracks or whatever, or the 500 right. block, they still, you know, have issues. So I think that was things around it. And just the you know, the stress of going to college. I will say something that is interesting. You know, the reason that Andrea Zuckerman, of course, would be coveting Yale is because at this point, you know, we thought, hey, our kids should go to Yale. Yale's pretty good.
Yeah.
Karen and Charles.
Yeah.
By the time our kids were grown and were applying to schools like that, thank you, hello, University of Pennsylvania. Yale is a school for spies. You know, what we didn't like about Yale. But at that point, oh, Yale. So we did put it up there. And I thought it was interesting how I thought in looking at it that we've learned a lot about these characters, Donna, and how the interesting, she had an interest in art and how that could spark you into going to that kind of thing, or that there's community college was mentioned and all this. So I think it was an interesting overture of looking at college, and all our kids were really going through college. And of course, and most of them had come to some kind of conclusions, still left unrealized. Kelly, David, and Dylan.
Yeah. And well, and Kelly, Dylan, and Brenda, and that triangle is still happening. I have to tell you, in the debate of, you know, sometimes you can look, I have a lot of perspective away from this, but you were right. My generation at this time was watching the show. We were all doing this stuff. We were having these conversations at school. Who doesn't want to go to college? Who's going to college? What's the SAT situation like? You know, all of these things. And I definitely had friends that were probably like the Andrea Zuckermans, who were very stressed about getting into the school that they wanted to. So if you had left that out of the conversation and these kids just were like the Simpsons and stayed an age and never grew up, the show would have been done next year. So you were, I mean, sorry, Mr. Spelling.
I just didn't have done for Charles Rosen, for sure, because I just wouldn't have known what was on their minds, you know? And it's not just that I went to Beverly Hills High School. You know what was an interesting thing about this episode? I'm not sure they did a Beverly Hills, West Beverly Hills.
No, I don't think they did. Oops.
Oh, my. Maybe the insurance let up. But we did not have one in this, now that I think about it.
No.
When we did the Beverly Hills, I mean, you know, it wasn't that much different. It didn't matter. These conversations would be happening. And what I have known now, that in terms of the conversation about that Andre was having with Gil,
yes,
and he would say, oh, don't you think I'm fit and I'm this? But the fact of the matter is that when you're a public school kid applying to an elite private school, the Ivy League seeing themselves as the most elite, but there were other schools mentioned, Northwestern, Duke, and this, but you're a public school kid, you're at a disadvantage. I did not know that when we were writing in the 90s, because I hadn't seen not just my kids, but kids after kids after kids seeing results, seeing what they come. And then, of course, the competition. But I also really love the fact that, you know, was college really as important? And if Mr. Spelling would have let me have all these kids be in other places and being doing other things and then come together, not other colleges necessarily. I didn't not necessarily have to send Dylan McKay to college. He wanted Dylan McKay to go to college. What would he have done differently? You know,
right.
So they were, you know, you make a creative choice and you got to go down that lane. And
that's, sure. All right.
But I also need to say one thing. This episode would not have happened without Gabriel Carteris having gotten herself into great shape and being part of the high wire, the circus of the network stars, which was a CBS franchise. And that CBS chose somebody from Fox to be on that. It was an acknowledgement that there was another network. So I think that was big. And we used it very well. And, you know, we don't really think about Andrea Zuckerman because she's brainy, because she's shorter, as a really stellar athlete. But you cannot do what she did crossing a rope like that with the balance of that unless she had some skills.
Yes. And I do want to talk about that. We have an interview with Bethany Rooney in a little bit where she talks about shooting some of those scenes. So I'm looking forward to that. I want to talk about the legacy key. This is something we've never really touched upon. We were always hoping that Ian would join us. We're still waiting on that. But I want to talk about it. What?
I guess he's ashamed that he had to resort to such ne'er-do-well kind of ethics.
I see. Must
be that, right?
It has to be, yes. All right, so talk to me about the legacy key.
Well, the legacy, I do not know when the legacy started. However, I do know who offered me to, that, you know, some of the perks of the key. And I knew that that person had an older brother. And that older brother was in my sister's grade in high school. So let's say that it started around 1964, 1965, maybe in the early 60s like that. So by the time my graduation, I didn't know it. But by 1968, I was a sophomore, seniors, someone mentioned about the legacy key, told me about it, told me how they were using it. And how it really basically cost a nice bottle of high-end scotch to get the access. When the episode aired, and anyway, so I heard about it, and that's all I did. When I was becoming a senior, like the week before school, I was offered the key, and it was thanks, but no thanks. Not for any, you know, everybody knows, you know, I would be ethically challenged. Oh, wow. I can get ahead.
Change all your grades.
Love that idea. But I was also a realist and I didn't want to get caught.
Of course.
So I passed on it. And I think you and I have discussed that the night that this episode aired or that the legacy key was first brought up, I got a telephone call from the person who now is deceased, but who offered me the key. And he was in Los Angeles and he was freaked out. And I said to him, you know, let's call him Mike. Mike,
okay.
what do you, you and I are the only two people that know this. And I kind of calmed him down.
Yeah. You didn't say Mike.
But I could never say his last name. I just gave you his first name. Anyone who wants to be a sleuth at the yearbook of the class of 1969, maybe you could figure it out.
Was he a prominent person that would not want that to have happened?
He was it was stupid that he even had it. He was a very good student.
I see.
But he cut corners.
This is one way for sure.
Yeah, he had his own thing. If I told you one thing about him that would really illustrate his personality and like, why would you do this? There are a few people out there who might be, would be able to identify him.
Got it. All right. Well, in the world of Beverly Hills 90210, the TV show, there was somebody that Steve Sanders had to get through, to, you know, to get the key because he had the wrong key, and it's him. Hello, it Jeff.
Hello.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
Our janitor. Jeff, how are you, man? It's good to see you. Thanks for all the scheduling stuff. I know it's been a second.
You're on the road, I guess, huh?
Yes. I was on the road, and unfortunately, the road was not adapting to my time change. you know how the road can get. But
you need a road key.
But really, really so much fun. What did he say? Sorry?
You need a road key. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, or, you know, even better than a road key, I use a driver. you would understand that, too. As someone who used to love, I drove across country. I loved it. It's now, where's the rest area? You know. But really enjoyed watching this episode. This is one of the ones, Jeff, you wouldn't know this, and we haven't talked about this yet. This was one of Mr. Spelling's least favorite episodes. I was very good, he said modestly, but truthfully, we would put together really very detailed outlines, and they would get submitted. The reason I saw it as a self, and I taught at UCLA for a number of years, and I saw it as a protective thing for a writer to do, because if you put everything in the outline, and your producer, director, network, or if they all read the outline, and they sign off on the outline, when you get to the script, you can't then say, what's this part? It was in the outline. Mm. And believe me, I was a movie of the week writer, and it saved me because people could never remember what they approved. I could remember because I had an outline. Thank you very much. So this was one, you know, here we were in the third season by this point. And unlike the first season where we were just on a, like, are we going to get through the first 12? When are they canceling this thing? And the second season was all teenage hijinks and you know, everything. And Mr. Spelling would have loved if we could have done that for 6 or 7 years in a row. But, you know, the problem is that he also liked things to be in real time.
Right.
He liked to have the Christmas episode. He liked to have the Valentine's Day episode. He liked et cetera, et cetera. Well, if you're in the calendar in real time, time marches on.
Right.
So we, you know, what were we going to do? And we got to that impasse, and the network understood where my problem was, because I say once you at a certain point, you have to be thinking about college in the way that kids were in the 80s and 90s. That was on their minds. And although our show was always the 90s, it was my experience in the 70s and in a suburban urban high school like Beverly Hills High School, and so we had to do the moving forward. Nonetheless, this was the episode where college was first really talked about.
Mm.
And he just scribbled all over the page on that poor writer, you know, who I saw, you know, one of the things, did you get a chance to look at the episode itself, Jeff?
I haven't seen it recently. I remember when I did three, so I'm not sure exactly which one this one is. But
well, this was the first one. This is when you established that he has to come to you to get you because he can never remember his locker combination. I don't know where that came from.
Right. Jeff, did you get into the casting process? We interviewed Bethany Rooney, and she says that the two of you were friendly and have known each other for years. Is that how you auditioned for 90210 or no?
No, I did not know Bethany back then.
Hmm.
We've only really become closer in the last 10, 12 years. But I did know... I think they just called me in. But when I got in there, I ran into Jessica Klein. And she was one of the writers. And her husband, Steve Wasserman, they were writers. And I was a friend of theirs, but they didn't know I was coming in. And then when I did the audition, she, I think, I don't know, either she caught me on my way out or something. I don't remember if she called me later and said, I was so happy that you just nailed the audition and I didn't have to say anything. They just did all the talking and you got hired. So,
well, Jeff, that's good. You know, and also Jessica, what was, I guess, a little more was less vocal then, because she knowing Steve and Jessica, Steve, took his prime task away from writing as being post-production, but Jessica was very involved in the casting process, given what the two were interested in.
But she didn't want to have to swing it for me, she said.
She didn't need to.
I didn't have to.
And also,
did all the talking, so you got hired on that. So.
That's exactly right. Yeah, you know, Paul and I like to yap and let the director but it would be not it would it was you know I had the justification of going through your IMDb credit, and I sometimes those are accurate, sometimes they're not, but you played everybody. You've played the New York Times critic. You've been Rabbi Greenberg. You've been the janitor. You've been all this. And it was interesting, too, though. Here you've been this great character actor in recurring roles, series regulars, everything for all of this time. And I think a credit to your personality. It was pretty hard to, not many bad guys. You don't go in.
I've done a few, and they were really fun.
I bet it is, but you know that's what you get when you have a nice personality and a sweet face. You're not going to get to be. As a janitor that this was your domain. I mean, in effect, the janitor was one of your bad guys.
I was going to ask you: do you think this is a bad guy?
Yeah, I think he is.
What do you remember about shooting this? Shooting these episodes on 90210.
Well, I worked with Ian and nobody else really. He was great. He was, he was willing to work things with me and stuff. But basically, I had my take on the character, and I knew I wanted to be a hard-nosed guy, and I knew I had this kid over a barrel. So I was pulling power plays on him, yes. and if I could make a little money on the side, so I just thought, well, that's easy enough. I mean, you just be kind of an ass.
You had this one really terrific line, and it's hard. Sometimes you look back at these lines and you wonder, especially for myself, who did a lot of rewriting. Oh, was that the writers, or did I come up with that wonderful moment? I'll give them all to the writer, because that's the way it should be. But I love the part in the scene where you catch him and you're after this key, and you start in the front of the scene saying you're not the first, and how did you get into it? The money? Well, there may be something more for you. Well, because again, you're not the first.
Yeah.
And so it really was, kind of you had your power center, your domain. It was a question of, so we were able to use it in how we did. I don't know if you were able to hear the conversation I was having with Pete before you joined us. But there was a legacy key at Beverly Hills High School. A few people I knew called it. It was you were smarter than I think the janitor at Beverly High, who I was told just took high end scotch, and that was enough. Didn't need really greenbacks. But
Jeff, did you get recognized from this part? I mean, this was 90210 season 3. It's a huge, huge show at this point. And did people recognize you as the janitor anywhere, or did that happen to you?
Sure. It's funny how ordinarily I don't get recognized. Although my wife tells me as we walk through a mall or walking down the street that people do double takes and do that kind of thing as I'm walking by, but I don't notice it. I'm just thinking my thoughts and doing my thing. But you're right. I've played so many parts, and a lot of them I'm unrecognizable as Jeff Doucette. In that one, I was recognizable, but I just got done playing Ben Franklin. I've done about five or six of those, but I've also done, I'm playing Senator Sam Irvin in this upcoming Stars show called Gaslit with Julia Roberts and Sean Penn.
Yes.
I play Sam Irvin, the head of the Watergate committee. And me? I mean,
you're playing him as the
Watergate hearings, yeah.
Well, I will tell you something. You won't meet that many people who went to it almost every single day. I was an intern at Washington for Congresswoman Yvonne Brathwaite Burke. And I was between my junior and senior year at Cal Berkeley, and she was pregnant. And so she didn't put in that many hours. And the more her interns, she had committee work. So we did that. We really kept on the committee work. So it was fascinating in that regard. But my afternoons were pretty free. There was some constituent letters, or I could get on the little train and go to the Senate side, show my little pass, and sit in the back and watch history. And that's what I did. So Sam Irvin was there. Yes.
And I made him dress me in that light blue suit. That's the thing I remember most about him. You remember that?
I don't remember.
Well, when you see the show, you'll probably see it. He wore a light blue suit, and I just went, oh, I got to have that light blue suit. That was just iconic to me.
Well, I remember that the irony of it being Sam Irwin at the time. Here's this guy, Pete, you know, and he is leading a bipartisan coalition between him and Howard Baker, a conservative Republican from Tennessee. At this point, he'd be a liberal from Tennessee. Right. That's what he was. But together. But here was Sam Irvin, the Democrat, you know, with the party of the liberals, wanting to get to the bottom of this. And he's a segregationist.
Hmm. Yeah, he was one of the old Dixiecrats.
That he sure was. He
fancied himself, I'm just a country lawyer.
Yeah.
I'm just a country lawyer and I have common sense kind of thing. And you know who reminds me of that now? That guy Kennedy from Louisiana.
Mm.
Man, I went to the same place. I like Sam Irvin a lot more than that Kennedy guy from Louisiana.
Oh, me too.
Irvin, because, you know,
wait, guys, let me get you back to 90210.
Jeff and I need to have this one round of good, and you get
go ahead.
Part in, because the thing about that country lawyer from Louisiana, that Kennedy guy, where'd he go to school? Harvard.
Yeah.
Phony asshole. Anyway.
Yeah. But back to the 90210 stuff, and I will leave that in for you guys.
Thank you.
Do you still, it's 30 years later, you're in this big 90s show. What is your thoughts on all of that? Like, I mean, that people are still talking about the stuff from the 90s now.
Well, I thought, you mean, what are my thoughts about it then or now?
Now, yeah. Oh, well, now. Then and now, I guess, but now, yeah.
Well, now, well, it's 30 years ago. So, I guess I don't really spend that much time thinking about it, and people don't really talk about it that much anymore. But, I mean, I'm happy to have done it, especially a three episode arc was nice because I got to dig in a little bit and feel in the smallest little way that I was part of the cast, you know. Because usually as a guest, you come in and you're gone the next week. And so you might remember some names. They might remember your name. But this was nice. And I was working a lot at that time. So it was in my heyday. The 80s and mid-90s up to the mid-late 90s. And now again, all of a sudden, I'm working a lot again. But I don't know. It was a good time in my life, and I was having a lot of fun. Steve and Jessica were dear friends of mine. And
how do you know them? How did you connect with them, Steve and Jess?
My roommate, where I was living, was Steve's friend from school or something.
Oh.
And they used to come over to my house, and we would I had this barbecue called a hasty bake. And we would just laugh all the time. They'd come over and it would take like forever to smoke because it was a smoker, you know, and it would take forever. And we'd get so drunk waiting for the food to be ready. And we would just laugh and laugh and just became great, great friends. And then I'd go up to their house and we'd hang out there and they'd cook a goose or something unusual. and we just spent our time laughing all the time.
Yeah.
And they had some really interesting friends too. So it was just a cross breed of.
This was you're talking about their house they had up in Griffith Hill, Park.
Yeah.
Up there, yeah. Los Feliz. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was off of no, not the Los Feliz one. This was when they lived up Outpost.
Ah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, thank you for joining us and talking about your time here on 90210. I thought it was awesome to have you. Chuck, do you have any more questions for Jeff regarding this?
Just one minor question relative to your director, Bethany Rooney. Has she directed you in other things?
Has she since? Yes. I was a recurring regular on Desperate Housewives, and she did two or three of those.
Right.
But, you know, I think she was one of the first women directors I worked with. I mean, there weren't that many back then.
No, I was looking at her. There was a show, I forget, called Slap Maxwell.
And I did that one, too. And
she, that was her first ones.
Oh, well, I was on her first one then. And then I saw her on Beverly Hills 90210.
And then she was on, and then right from then she did St. Elsewhere. And as I was telling Pete, I wrote for St. Elsewhere, and I had some typing needs, and she was Bruce Paltrow's assistant, and in her spare time, Beth Hillshaver did typing for illiterate writers, and so that's how I met her.
Well, that was Beth Hillshaver. I worked with her, too.
That's Bethany Rooney. It's the same.
It is Bethany Rooney. Yeah. It's the same person. Okay.
That's it.
Yeah.
I didn't know her.
Yeah, well, you see, you've been really, you know, well, you've got something new to talk about next time you see her in church.
There you go.
Well, all knew each other back then. There was a whole lot of people. I knew all the St. Elsewhere cast because I was recurring on Newhart for 5 years. And they were right
the same commissary.
That soundstage was right next to us. And so, and I was in acting class with Mark Harmon for years. And I was playing on softball teams with some of those guys. And it was. We all knew.
Well, you know, MTM was the place to be. It was where everyone wanted to be, myself included. So I do my St. Elsewhere episodes, and I turn in the second one, and Bruce Paltrow, Greta's father, gets furious at me for something we don't need to get into, having to do with, oh, yes, money. And so he's screaming at me as I'm leaving the building, and it's one building. Everything that was in MTM world was one building, and I'm leaving it and the Radford place, and he's saying, you let your agent know, let him know you'll never work for MTM again. You hear me? Never work for MTM again. And I, oh my God, I'm never going to work for him. I get in the car, I drive home. I have one message on my machine. It's for to come in because they want me to do an episode of Remington Steel. And my meeting's the next day. So the next day, I drove to the same studio, Radford. I parked in the same MTM area. I went into the same building, except instead of turning left and on the first floor, I went up the stairs where they were. And that's my MTM story.
Amazing.
Yes, I appreciate it. A little bit of real showbiz on our little podcast here.
All right, Jeff, thank you so much for your time. It's much
thank
appreciated.
You.
All right.
Take care, Jeff. Good to see you, sir. All right. Stay well. Bye-bye. Happy Easter.
Thank you.
Hey, Chuck, is it cool if we cut right now? I have to do this 10:30 thing. And then, yeah. And then I'll come back at 11 and we'll finish the rest with Bethany and all the other stuff.
You know, you can't, do you have to, what you have, is your rest of your day? Are you?
I'm little, totally open. So anytime
I got to pick up the dogs.
Okay. All right. That was great. Jeff, as the janitor, it was nice to catch up. Yes, Chuck?
Absolutely. You know, you go through and you start realizing these look at people you're interested in. You're interviewing guest stars.
That's right. Yes.
This man is a 45 year guest star.
It's incredible. It really is.
And you know, with that one thing, I don't know if you talk about this with some of the guest stars, but I always do that when I look at old movies. You know, and you start running down the credits and you want to see somebody like, oh, you know, man number three was Montgomery Clift or, you know, or somebody who was a big star or
right.
You know, what would later become. And you realize That doesn't happen very often. Less and less. If you really go through the movies in this and the old movies of the 60s, 70s, 80s, you realize that if you have a client and you want that client, and that client you think is going to be a star,
sure,
you only want them to take support, you know, roles that'll further their career, not roles that will pay their rent.
Exactly.
And yet there's that moment where you say, yes, I will play janitor number one and
right.
not hold out to be Jim Walsh. And obviously our friend made that choice.
Hudge is the name you guys gave him. Hudge the janitor is the name that you guys.
What do we call him? Hudge?
Hudge, I think it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't know where that one came from. That must have been a Wasserman contribution.
I wanted to ask you about one of the writers on this. We were talking before we came back from the break. is Star Frohman is credited as a writer on Highwire. Tell me about. We don't really hear that name often. That's not a name that we hear about. So tell me about Star Frohman.
Well, we brought in three sets of writers in this group that we felt we really needed for season three. One was the writing team of Biller and Brancato, who've both gone on to do terrific things as writers, as separately, not as a team. We brought in Chip, who is the Emmy winning and universally respected. And then the third was Star. And Star was obviously the one woman of the group. I know that she went to UCLA when Karen was there, because Karen knew of her in the theater department. She was very attractive and tall. I remember that. Always wore jeans. Almost never saw anything else than that. And I was very disappointed. I think of the scripts that she is credited for writing for us, I think this is her strongest.
Sure.
Partially because she had most time to do it and got most scrutiny. The same with 9 and 10. In fact, I remember when my birthday came around or something came around and someone was giving me something and Chip and Star's gift were for me from writers 9 and 10, because they knew from the moment they were hired prior to shooting 1 that these were their two episodes, because obviously we had the summer episodes.
Sure.
She opted because not to come back. And it's a technical reason, but.
She was offered to come back and so was Chip, right? You kept both of them on.
Well, Chip was never, that was, yes, they were there, but Chip understood at the same time. They were both writers, not producers. Writers don't get paid for the full episode. So in effect, it's a way for a company to save a week of payroll.
Got you.
It's all it is. The company thing, every single company does it. There is no writer I know that ever, that you just accept it. Who else accepted it? Well, prior to me coming to 90210, I had to even though I was the head writer and supervising producer, I was paid like a story editor in Northern Exposure, which basically meant that when my weeks were over, it was over. I wasn't going to be paid for every episode they did. And it was pretty clear that writers knew that coming in. I guess Star's agent forgot to tell her that. She took it personally. And she's was stubborn on it. And Star, I think you made a goof then and looking back 30 years ago, because I think there was a lot you would have brought to our party.
Yeah.
Fans would have really, judging from the, you know, the tone of this script and this, that really worked well, not only her own stuff, but also clearly even working in with me and Steve and Jess. You know, it was, you know, and Star, you want to know a, when she did, when the boat went boom, that's Star Frohman.
Wow. Yeah.
She was someone that, what, you know, was given, you know, responsibility. We needed our writers to step up.
Sure.
And the reason is we had so many effing episodes.
Yeah, exactly.
So we had some really nice writers, both in season 3, season 4, see different. And I just, even though I like them, I had to say bye.
Yeah.
Because if you can't, if I've got to spend too many days rewriting you.
Yeah. Not
I don't have any time to do all the other things like I do. I just sit on the phone and get either screamed at or screamed. You know,
sure.
We did a lot of that back then.
One of the comedy runners, I guess, of this episode is that David catches Kelly in the shower. And she feels, you know, it's a whole thing. And he's talking to the guy. He talks to Steve, and Steve knows about the body, you know, the part of the body that she has, or whatever. So it's really interesting and funny stuff. And I think it's one of the things that I remember a lot from 90210. So what is your take on looking back on that?
I think it all works. The only thing that I thought was a little cringeworthy, not just a little cringeworthy, is when Andrea asked the boys if they picture her naked.
I did catch that, yeah.
I don't know if CR Charles Rosen today would have let that moment pass.
And also, like, Steve says something to her like, is there something with that shake or some line that he almost like, ooh, this would not have made the cut at a show today.
No, I think there was another moment of pretty overt sexism said that was unusual. But again, you know, you have to, first of all, it's interesting as a woman writer. So there was less PC. The name of the television show on late night was called Politically Incorrect.
That's right.
You were allowed to be it a little more. I mean, Bill Maher has turned into kind of an old crab because
a lot of
the things that were okay 30 years ago, just, you know, and in a Me Too environment are not right. It was stupid. You know, here's this young woman, you know, wanting to go to Yale, and that's what's on her mind.
I know.
Do I really care what you guys think? At the same time, I thought it was perfectly okay that the guys would be in her dream on the high wire and that she would see. You know what I noticed in this episode was a lot of projection.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people thinking, well, this must be it, and since this must be it. And sometimes it's right on the mark. Like, I thought one of the most interesting lines in the entire script was when Donna says to Kelly, not right, but does point out, you're just jealous because I got a boyfriend and you don't.
And yeah, I love that.
You realize that, well, this is obviously informing how she's thinking and behaving. And then that story, that little line that she says, is what pretty much propels her to come over to that.
Yes.
To Dylan's house that night. And I think the other thing that is pretty interesting is that how Dylan at that point was only, all he's into is surfing and motorcycling. I don't know. I think that, again, you do things that you need in the moment, because Dylan McKay was mad, bad, dangerous to know. He's quoting Proust from his first episode.
Yes.
There's a little more going on than just those two things. And wouldn't Brenda have more insight into some of that than to rely on her father's points of view? And
yes.
I realized that, you know, despite how we portrayed Brenda and how she wanted to be portrayed, the one thing she obviously didn't really care for in things that we did is I noticed, gee, she is really susceptible to her father's point of view. She really is her daddy's daughter. It really does matter in that.
And that comes through in this episode too. You know what I mean?
So I thought these were some of the, for the kind of fans that are listening to this and are super about it, I thought those were some of the real interesting stuff up. There also was something just technically that was interesting. So you're in the Steve knows something's going on with David,
right?
And you're in the
radio booth,
and then you cut away to other material, and then you come back and you're picking them up again. But they're almost finished with the conversation. That's post production. clearly the scene was too long and I didn't need a lot of the, you got to tell me in this. It was uncomfortable. We had to cut time at a certain place. So we took a scene, put it in between a scene, a longer scene that was there, and we were able to pick it up when we were farther into it.
Oh, it's great though. It cuts out all the fat of the comings and goings of what may have happened.
So that's why you fix it. You change things in post.
I'm sure that was a common comment made around in the 92. We'll just fix it in post.
Not really.
No,
I know you. That's a common thing that television would say.
Yes,
but my scripts were pretty much, and I say this with again the awareness that we only went into only one episode, which we've talked about, East Side Story, without a script. Our scripts were always ready. There were stuff there. So we knew what we were getting for better or worse in a lot of times. The interesting thing, and maybe I promised I'll go back to try to look at this, in that we talked about that the episode that had the most stuff cut out of it was Presumption of Innocence.
I do want to talk about
With Bethany and that, because we took out full monologues. We just lifted them. And that was Bethany's really incredible editorial contribution to our entire series, but certainly that particular episode. Just because a director gets to go into post, often that doesn't mean the director is a very good editor. Sometimes they are, and sometimes you can find a better,
that's what the editor's there for, too, right?
I remember once in the first season, We had brought in a lot of Northern Exposure. Anytime a Northern Exposure editor became available, we want to bring the Northern Exposure in. Cut one for us, or cut two for us, right? It was a big, big thing, it seems, at the time. And we had a very powerful, a very good editor. An editor who went on, I think he won awards and stuff. And I remember him showing me a scene he had put together. And I said to him, okay, here are my notes. Every time you cut to the one character, cut to the other character. Do everything exactly in reverse. I want to see exactly. Yeah, to reverse it.
Oh, that must have been especially back in those days, non-digital film universe, right?
Wasn't even the part of that. So, we were on one of the first digital editorial shows.
Oh, were you? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why I encourage you, get Kenny Miller on here. You should talk to him.
Oh, okay.
He's a lot to add. You don't need me on the show. Mm-hmm. You really should talk to him because we were the first. It was the first time Spelling had used digital, and it was a very, it was brand new and stuff. So the editors were learning on it too.
Sure.
And there were a lot of things that really allowed us to do stuff like that. No, I was going when I told a top editor, I don't like anything of how you edited. Do it the exact opposite.
I can't imagine
with the ego editor. Blow. Oh. Not even the amount of time. The ego blow had to be. We never were buddies after that.
No, I imagine he won't be coming on the podcast.
And Jonathan might, but we knew him through our children's elementary school. Mm-hmm. It was just a coincidence. His wife taught there.
Come at it.
But I haven't thought about ever him having to do that, but yes, he did. And it's not,
must not have been fun. All right. I want to set up this interview we have with Bethany Rooney. She's going to be really great. I did it a little bit earlier when you were in between Arizona and California.
Yeah. And somewhere between Arizona and hell.
I'm going to play that now and then we'll come back from it.
Beautiful.
Okay, I am with Bethany Rooney, who directed High Wire a long time ago.
A very long time ago.
Well, you looked back on some of it. Did anything shoot back at you? Like, I remember directing that scene.
Yeah. This is a weird thing. I have a neck like anybody else, but I struggle with looking up. And Gabrielle was on, up on a wire. And I remember asking the prop guy to bring a chaise lounge from one of the other sets that I could. So I laid down on that chaise lounge to direct Gabrielle, and Luke, and
Gil Myers, and
Gil, yes,
and Jason was up there. I mean, those were pretty trippy scenes. And you know, I mean, you did a lot of 90210, so you've done sort of the dreamy stuff at some point, but this was really, this is kind of out there. What did you think when you read this and kind of like shooting it?
Well, it's always fun. It's really genuinely fun for a director to get something outside the box. Directing inside the box is great too, but when you get something that allows you to expand your I don't know, I expand the box, I guess, that you're in. There's another word that I can't think of. But anyway, allows you to just shoot things in a different way or go about them a different way, or it's a challenge to the director and it's fun. So, though I don't remember exactly how I felt when I read that script because it was so darn long ago, I do know that anytime I, as a director to this day, get something unusual, it sparks my little creative impulses.
And I think Gabrielle had some experience walking, whatever that is, high wire.
She took lessons. That's what I remember. She took lessons for quite a while and was very proud of herself for achieving that. When I looked at that first scene of her on the high wire, I wished I would have connected her feet to her face more so that the audience really knew that it was she doing it. Because it really was. There wasn't any other person, like there wasn't a stunt double or anything doing it, which is unusual and rare.
That's such a director's mindset, though, to look at something 30 years ago and be like, I wish I would have. Do you do that sometimes in some of the, I mean, you've directed so much stuff now, and the work is absolutely incredible, but do you still do some of that?
Of course, because it can always be better, right? I mean, even stuff that I feel like I can't assess it when I'm too close to it, like stuff that I've done recently. But looking back on it with all that time, I think, I'll tell you what, watching what I watched today, I was pleased with the camera movement, but I felt like I could have done a few more bits of coverage of people. Like, for example, that there was an early scene where Jason was kissing somebody and then I went around them.
I remember that shot. I love that shot though.
Yeah, I did too, but I didn't have Jason's coverage. And I know the reason I didn't was because the logic of, well, where was the camera if she was up against the locker? Because I personally would have an issue with that. Like, you know, clearly you've broken the set apart to shoot it. And I really don't want people to be aware of that. But watching it, I wish I would have seen Jason's face. So then that made me think, oh, maybe I should have staged it differently. You're always critical of your work, right?
And oh my God, it's so great. But that, I mean, what I liked about that shot was because we don't really see things like that in the hallway at 90210. You know what I mean? We don't, you know, usually it's just that one, like, or a lot of coverage or one shot kind of a deal. You know what I mean? And you kind of move the camera around a little bit. I think that's one of the things, like, even just like when Brian, you know, had, or David had seen Kelly earlier, and then we kind of see them later on in the hallway. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of hallway stuff happening.
There was a lot in that episode.
Yeah. And so you had to make choices, I assume, about like, well, we'll move the camera here. We won't do this here. Just so it feels a little bit different every time we're in the hallway.
Yeah. And watching it now, I was pleased with it as a general thing about, oh, I didn't remember that I had done that much of that because, you know, there was very little hallway there. I mean, literally, there was about 50 feet of hallway and a couple of, you know, T returns on the ends in a stairwell. So it was challenging to come up with something that looked a little different, you know, and that's, again, challenging is the fun part.
Sure. There's also some really great, because this is about the time when I don't know how much you remember of this, but like the Brenda, Dylan, and Kelly sort of triangle is in full effect. And you shoot this scene with Kelly coming over to see Dylan and whatnot. Were you aware of the magnitude of what was happening with that storyline? I mean, it's still, people still debate it to this day. You know what I mean? So it's kind of insane. But what's your thoughts on all of that and being a part of directing something that becomes culturally significant and iconic?
You know, the reality is you get up in the morning and you go to work and you shoot the day's work and hopefully you do a good job. And then you get up the next morning and repeat the process. While there is some aspect of the outer world intruding, in particular, I remember there would be, photographers with immensely long lenses trying to get shots of the cast. But we had good security and stuff. So anyway, that stuff would enter consciousness. But most of the time, you're in your little bubble there and doing the work as best you can. And honestly, truly, you can't think of where this is going to go or who's going to see it or who would have thought 30 years from now we'd be talking about it. You just can't do that because it would be intimidating and it might impact stuff. So for me, you just got to stay with it. Like, for example, in this season, this that I just finished last night, very late, I directed some pretty famous and ongoing shows. That is Law & Order SVU and Chicago PD, for example, and some other ones. And, you know, those air all the time everywhere. And probably I could talk about them 30 years from now, but that's just not a point of view that helps do the daily work, you know?
I do know what you mean. And have you, like, have, as you've done a lot of directing 90210, post 90210, is that something that you've come to realize or something that you've realized through the process of it?
What do you mean?
Well, because, you know, after you do a 90210 and it becomes explosive and, you know, it's all over in the sort of in the universe, You, I'm sure you can look back on that and be like, oh, I directed that episode, or I directed Shannon, or I was a part of that pop culture-y kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And now as you go on directing other things, do you still just like say, okay, well, I have to just treat it like I did 90210? Because I'm sure you've directed other episodes, like you said, of Law & Order and other things that wound up being significant in those universes.
The way I'll answer that question is I was looking at something earlier today where someone was advising directors to take photos on set, which I almost never do. I don't have any photos of me with those actors because at the time we didn't have our phones, but also I don't want to be the outside person who says, hey, can I take a picture with you? Because that makes it feel like I'm not with them. That like I'm separate from them. So I don't want to be separate from them. I want to be in their bubble and not perceived to be, I don't want to make a big deal about it. We're just there to do the work and be creative together and be happy together. But taking pictures like you're a tourist mm-hmm. with actors is, It says I'm separate from you and I don't want that. So, well, I'm really happy to have worked with those actors and loved them, some of them very, very much. I mean, like it hurt me to watch Luke today. I don't have any pictures of myself with Luke. I just have wonderful memories.
I want to ask you about that. What is that like looking? I mean, and he's a uniquely special person, right? I mean, he's a good giving.
He was, person. Yes.
So what is that like to look back on Luke Perry's performances as an actor, something that you directed in this show?
I think he was really gifted. I think he was so empathetic and so natural and so real and so sweet as a human being. And, I didn't have the opportunity to work with him in later years. Like I didn't direct Oz or I didn't direct that show that he shot in Canada. You know which one I mean?
Maybe it was Riverdale, or yeah.
No, it wasn't. I didn't do Riverdale, but before that, he was like a it was a period piece, and he was a sheriff or something in a small town. Whatever. Point being, the only time that I ever worked with him was 90210. But I would see him occasionally, see his work, and think, oh my gosh, you're special. You're special. I mean, Jason is special too. They all were, because to do that show, to do 90210 and in that time and place and be surrounded by all this craziness that they were, they, you know, sort of attacked their world, and for them all to maintain and be good people. I really respect that.
Not easy. You know, I don't know. I don't know if it would be the same in the generation of social media and, you know, influencer actors that have shows and whatnot.
I think it was safer for everyone's mental space before social media. I know a lot of people who don't do it, or who have stepped back from it, that it's just too weird to open yourself up to what other people think, especially other people, millions of other people who have an opinion. And why should you care what their opinion is? You know, it was hard enough to be Jason and Luke, or Ian, or and Brian too, to go out to these shopping center appearances on the weekends and be surrounded by screaming crowds, just like the Beatles were, basically. That the fact that they grew up and became maintained being a decent human being is kind of an amazing thing.
For sure. Last, I want to ask you about this legacy key. Steve is gets the key to the janitor's office. You know, what did you think about shooting some of that? We're going to have the actor on that was the janitor with us.
Yeah. That's so funny, because watching this show, I didn't remember that Jeff was in it. I didn't remember it. My friend Mary Kate was the art teacher. I didn't remember my friend Denise Dowes was the, you know, counselor. So funny. It just, you know, you put it away in the box of memories. And Jeff, my husband reminded me, Jeff, it can be seen currently as Benjamin Franklin on a commercial for cryptocurrency, I think it is.
And you directed you directed it?
No, I directed him in another thing, again, many, many, many years ago. And then we had a social cross-section, church, actually. He's a great guy. Hope you have fun. In terms of Steve getting the keys to the closet, I mean, that's a hilarious story. And, you know, it must have been hard for the writers to come up with apt, interesting, different stories in a high school and in those families for all those years. I really tip my hat to them.
I think Chuck said that it actually happened. So,
really?
So a friend of his got a key, the key to the school. Yeah.
See, that's the great background stuff to know. That's great.
I was going to ask you, what did you think of, since we'll have Jeff with us and you're friendly with him, or were, what did you think of his performances as the janitor here? I think he's a critical, he sells this, right? I mean, the janitor being who he is, I know it's probably more of a comedy piece of the show, but I think he really brings something special to it. What did you think of Jeff's work in this episode?
He always does that, whatever he does. He's a really, really good actor. You know, who finds the truth, the central truth of a character, regardless of what, how he's supposed to be plugged into the episode. So he's plugging in, or meant to plug in, as a comedy, you know, accent, but Jeff will always go for what's at the center of that human being, and the comedy goes on top. And it's great to find actors like that.
The fun stuff with David and Kelly, in at the top with the shower and all that stuff. Do you have any memories of doing any of that?
No, not a one. I was like, oh, look at that. I must've shot that. And I have not a single memory. I do have a memory of that house because I was the first director to shoot that house, and I know exactly where it is, and I could drive to it right now. But it's just funny what sticks with you and what doesn't. I loved her too. I loved her a lot. Jenny was great to work with. And I had some major storylines for her, you know, through the episodes that I did.
What about Shannon?
What about her?
She's got a big storyline here too that's happening with Brandon and the school and all that. What was Shannon like to work with?
I would have to say that is the one actor in that cast that I never connected with on a human level, on a let's be friends level, on a I understand you level. She was just had barriers up that I could not permeate. So, you know, at this time in my life, when I've had so much more experience with actors, I wish I could go back in time and try to understand her better. That would be a nice thing. But at the time, we didn't have it.
That's interesting. Oh, well, one day when we have you back, we'll explore more of that, because I think there's some interesting stuff there. But this has been great. Thank you for popping in and helping us with this episode. It's good.
That's my pleasure.
A puzzle. I think your work is amazing in this and the stuff that you have done afterwards.
Thank you for saying that. I appreciate it very much.
All right, cool. Good seeing you, Bethany. Appreciate
you. Thank you, too. Bye.
All right. I mean, it's always interesting to hear Bethany. I want to ask you about a few things. She says that she had to get someone to give her something so that she has some sort of neck issue. Are you aware of that? And she,
I don't remember that, but you know what was so interesting to hear that is that how many shots were different than you'd find in a spelling show? There was a lot of things, and a lot of them were low angles coming up. That's where somebody's got a neck.
But talking about that and about her direction of Gabby walking on the high wire, and we kind of touched upon this a little earlier, Gabby had trained herself for Circus of the Stars on CBS, right? So she was, and Bethany's comment was that she wishes when she looked back on it that she reshot it differently because she wanted people to know that that was actually Gabby on the high wire. And she doesn't know that she has a shot that indicates that this is Gabby. Did you pick that note up?
Yes, and I can see that. You know, I mean, she did not do the wide shot from looking up. You didn't do that, which is, in one sense, would be surprising. Oh, how could they not prove it was her? But we weren't trying to prove it.
Right.
In other words, we were just trying to make the best section, and that is, we knew, us who were making it, that's our friend Gabrielle Carteris, who's worked out to be sitting, being on a tightrope like that. So who do we need to convince about it?
Right. You know? That's like a show about like Gabrielle Carteris. Andrea was just having an inner dream about Gil Myers and all this. So there's no really a real need to see it.
Right. Right. And the Yale thing, and I think we talked about that it was just, it just seemed, we just picked the school at random, but it seemed like a right place that someone as a 10-year-old, 12-year-old, where would I want to go to school? I would go to that old American, you know, university.
That star Froman came up with the concept of the dream that way, or is it a combination of you guys? Because my question is, when you read it, I mean, and then you see it, it's really, I think it's executed really nicely. I think Bethany does a pretty good job of showing a dream, and we'll see more dreams down the line in your brain through the show, you know. What did you think about it when you saw it on paper versus when you actually saw it? Did it match up?
Well, you mean the actual
the dream.
Yeah, I think it did, and I also like the fact that when she fell, she actually fell off the couch. I like the fact that we showed that this is a woman who sleeps on the couch.
Yeah,
she's done her own bed, which we never really saw.
That's true.
Well, then, so I thought that was really interesting. And getting back to Bethany's direction, not quite on the tightrope with you, but just because I want to get this in before I forget. those of you who go back and watch this episode over again, you know, for this particular one, I'm sorry we couldn't do a watch along this week. I really wanted to because I was seeing it for the first time in many years. I wanted to, you know, find reactions and be filtered into that. But there was one moment that I called it, right? Knew exactly what it was. Notice one of the Steve can't get his locker open in the beginning. And he's there and he sits there and he looks down the hallway. And all of a sudden, two women, high school young women, walk into his space. And you see them both really well. You know the shot I'm talking about?
Yeah. Here? Uh-huh.
Okay, you know what that, you know why that was set up that way?
No, uh-uh.
Because those two women, one we put it, maybe it was only one set of parents, and it was for your daughter and a friend would get a walk-on part for 90210 for charity.
Oh, I see.
To get yourself into it. There's another one in the Party Fish episode, second episode of our summer series, where they're actually Jason's, you actually see Brandon walking by and say, oh, it's the Center Girls.
I do remember that.
That from the Center for Early Education, which is where my kids went to school. And that was an auction to be on our
set. Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah.
So, but that shot to me said, oh, that must be an auction. The other one that I thought was just great, and I don't know how it got set up, but there was an attractive couple. I noticed them as extras. It seemed to be extras. And maybe they also were an auction because all of a sudden a scene is going on and two kids we don't even know are just making out in front of their locker as if it's not Brenda and Dylan who you'd see or
sure.
Nikki Witt and Brandon or whatever combination, but two total strangers. Well, were we doing that with extras? Did Bethany say that would be a great thing? Let's have some kissing.
It's high school. Here. Yeah, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Or was it somebody who had an on-camera thing? You come on, you're doing our show, and you get to do that, and you bring a friend, and yes, you want to be in the camera? Kiss your girlfriend.
That's right pretty here. Cool. Yeah.
Well, those shots, you know, were, you know, part of the fun.
Oh, you also mentioned Nikki Witt and Brandon. There's that little storyline in this as well, on top of everything else. That's a part of this.
I thought Nikki got one really nice, really, really nice line, too, as we were talking about why it was important to have senior year and different things is to have a character like Nikki Wizard. Well, I don't know if I want a boyfriend who's a senior is going to go away for college.
Mm-hmm.
Hello. Isn't that at every high school everywhere?
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, I even remember it for myself. I had my high school girlfriend and I, we had a relationship was rocky. Sometimes it was really great. And then sometimes it wasn't. And there was a young girl and, wow, you know, yeah, let's start to, what do you mean? Yes, I'm graduating in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Maybe not, you know.
On the other show, Jenny's and Tori's, but Tori wasn't there, they said Gil sometimes comes across as a little creepy, but I didn't really get that vibe off of Gil in this, did you?
What Gil... Well, if I remember the whole thing about starting the high school and senior was that Andrea was not the editor and that he made it, you know, hard for her to be given the status that she felt she deserved. He wanted Brandon to get there. So he was a little not as sympathetic.
Sure.
What young women are going through. So I saw that as part of it. And then where he comes off, so it seems that he was a little flippant in the Yale conversation.
Sure.
However, what he was basically saying to somebody who's got their heart set on Yale is, and unless you're a legacy, really all you can have good great grades, all you really can say is good luck.
Right.
And she's all hyped up and he's trying to tamp her down a little bit. So maybe that's the condescension.
Sure.
That he comes off as creepy in the high wire stuff. I'm going to tear you down. I'm going to, it's completely Andrea's projection.
Yes.
And so I don't, he's acting, being directed to act that way.
Exactly.
And remember, you have to remember about how an actor comes across in a role and how a director interprets that role is that every episode starts with a tone meeting. And every episode, every director has got to sit across from me and we go through the script line by line and me explain the script. It's brutally patronizing to say, this is where the humor is. This is where the motion is. This is where this.
But you have to do it.
But the more importantly, it has to be said, to run a good, effective machine television, the conversation between the director and the person in charge, the showrunner, whatever you're saying, has to be done in front of the line producer, the person who's really running the production, to avoid a director coming up to a producer and saying, well, Charles told me I could do it.
Right.
You know, yeah. And so if you have the one basic conversation in front of both things, that was a
can never be said.
Thank right. you, Duke. Thank you, Duke Vincent.
Yeah, that is a pretty, that is pretty
no
smart.
No director. And by the way, when a director did try to get around and did not follow the one thing, even though he was a really nice guy, and I know I reacted too harshly with him, he never was invited back. You got to do it. You know, and the only advice, listen, it's the advice I give to my daughter when she turned in a script recently to Netflix. Turn in what you pitched. Don't, you know, tell, do what, they, give them what they think they're expecting to get. Instead of, oh, I had this wonderful idea and I took everything out that I told you I was going to do. Instead, I did this.
It's great advice.
That's not your job. Your job is to deliver what
you pitched. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. I think that's good advice for all projects.
Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay, let's see if there's any other things in this that we need to talk about.
Well, I think we really did blow something, though. I really do. And I think it's just, and possibly because we weren't listening as closely in this episode or didn't envision how important Donna Martin would become. Two things is you hear her talk about her father and, oh, my father this, and my father doesn't really respect me and things I just, but, well, we know that's not how Dr. Martin was portrayed.
It's true.
Once we met Dr. Martin. So we were just having her talk about her generic father to set something up that seemed right for where we were with that character at that time. But once that character has to become real, and
then it was totally changed. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So we had to change that. And I noticed that. And you'll probably see that throughout. I mean, oftentimes talking about Kelly's father, or I know because they brought him back, or Jack McKay, or that, you know, or, and we actually saw a different Jack McKay at one point, and you saw a different Kelly Taylor's father at one point. You know, you do what you have to do. But I think where we blew, or weren't really listening close enough, when she got such praise for being an artist, why we didn't get her into fashion design while she was going to California University?
I know.
Did they ever do fashion design?
She does do that. That is where her career winds up. She does, and even later on in the series, she opens a store, a clothing store. She has a merchandise line, of dresses and stuff. So
designs.
Yes, they definitely follow up with that later on in her.
Well,
in her.
Good. Then they.
The problem was that they blow it in the sense that where Donna Martin's not a successful designer. You know what I mean? They kept in the later seasons. Most of them, like, they were working on a newspaper. They had all these small careers where they should have had these, you know, she should have been the biggest designer, and the store should have been popping.
Yeah, Larry's point.
Yeah.
I have to be in total agreement with him. You want it to be an ordinary person with these huge stakes. You know, it's, you know, she's just a farm girl, but, you know, now she's the biggest designer. She's just Donna Martin. You know, oh my God!
She overcame a learning disability. She focused in on her art. How great would it have been a great success story that she had her line? I mean, she does do well with it. You know what I mean? But opens a store and all that stuff.
But
so
also, you know, and also, I don't know how they, but because those were things I was more interested than who stood in who.
Yes,
we would have focused really a long time on her getting some this and disappointments and. We could have done with art with her the exact same thing we did with David Silver
and music. Yeah. Yeah,
and that was there. That was looking at us right there for season four, and yet it was more about the sorority and this, and then of course once we, you know, once Brenda was gone, then all, her role would you know completely
be something else. Totally. All right. This is great. I think we covered everything in this episode. I'm trying to think if there's something else. We got Gil Myers. We got the High Wire. We got, we talked about Dylan and Kelly, uncertain about their school. There is some of the triangle stuff. He ends the, you know, I think
there was a lot. I think this was the introduction of it a little bit. And it's interesting. So this episode, I think there's, again, the week after is the football. But right after that, Monsieur Rick comes back into the world.
Yes.
I think he's coming back pretty quickly to get that moving up, you know?
Yeah, that's great stuff. This one also is when, you know, Kelly comes by and wants to be his friend. And, you know, I gave the quote sign for those listening. And, you know, he's on the phone with Brenda and he says, I love you too. It's a really awesome moment. You know what I mean? Because it really shows, like, where are they going? Where is all this going with the three of them?
Well, you sure looked at Dylan looking right at her saying, I love you.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't try to hide it. He didn't do it. I love you. He didn't whisper it. He said it right out loud. And he's not looking. He's looking at Kelly Taylor.
Yes.
And so it was. And, you know, Kelly saying, as you put in quotes, I'm here to be a friend. No, I think that we talked about, I thought in the previous segment, I think, is when she said, I got a boyfriend and you don't, says Donna Martin.
That's right.
And it has Kelly.
Triggered her.
Said, yeah. Why? Where is my boyfriend?
Right.
You know, and why am I grumpy about everything and obsessing about everything is because Rach all back to the triangle.
Yes.
Kelly, what's wrong? I know something's wrong with you, says Brenda. You know, Brenda's noticing it. I mean, it's impossible to avoid. In fact, I'll be truthful. You know, in life, I've always wondered about this. And it was always a thing. It's not my, this year, Karen and I will be in June, will be celebrating our 45th wedding anniversary.
Wow.
And I've been a faithful husband. And one of the reasons is that at a certain point, it didn't matter when it was. They said, ooh, if I was a major transgressor, she'll know.
Mm-hmm.
She'll pick up the vibe. Something will be different.
Right.
I can't put it, and I think that's because I believe in that kind of verbal,
sure,
you know, nonverbal stuff. But I think that's what's going on here. Something's out of whack, and we don't know yet because it isn't. We're not in Roxbury Park. And nobody's going like this to the
exactly. All right, this is a great episode to cover. I think
it was. Get me some other good ones, Pete. Ones we haven't covered, and we'll do it together. And
well, you mentioned the one too. I like this format of how we put it all together. You know, well, the incest one that you mentioned earlier is one that I think we should definitely cover.
We've
at some
not
point.
Covered that one.
We have not covered that. No.
Mm-mm. Okay. Yeah.
We need to try to get Jessica to pop in for that too, if we can. You know.
Well, Karen wrote it. I mean, that's all Karen Greenrosen.
Oh, then we need Karen. Yeah. Well, you have said that Jessica really went to the network and fought tooth and nail about getting incest. Well,
I've said, you know, all of us had our different roles and things we could do and didn't do. Nobody could pitch our stories better than Jessica Klein. Nobody could talk that fast and still have other people be able to hear what they were saying. She would talk fast, and it wasn't like, I'm talking fast so you'll get lost. I'm talking fast to show you how in control we are. We know this and this and this. Phenomenal. She did it with Aaron. She did it with the network. We'd walk in. I'd sit back. I'd just go, yes.
That's amazing.
And she loved to talk about that. Whenever Jessica's ready to feel like
back.
She wants to come back and be with us.
There's a couple of things. There's a couple of things too. I mean, there's the other storyline with Steve and the, and Molten Burl, right? So there's a lot of stuff we have
and
to
get. One we've never done, and one that we would certainly be doing a lot different if it was a different world, and that's BYOB. So
yeah, I want to cover that one too at some point.
We got some of those first third season, first years we can play around with.
Sure. All right, cool, man. Well, this has been great. I just want to encourage everybody to go to my Instagram. If you don't follow me there, I have an interview with Kathleen Robertson where she talks about swimming with sharks. A new show on Roku channel, Chuck. You have to get the Roku channel so you can catch up.
I got the Roku channel, and not only have I swam with sharks, figuratively, figuratively and literally. Where's my mouth? Literally and figuratively.
She's got a new show. 6 episodes are out tomorrow. Make sure everybody goes and checks it out. And I interviewed her on my Instagram Live.
Kathleen.
And you guys can take a look at that too. All right, Chuck, this has been great. We will see you soon and catch more of these episodes. All right. Thanks, man. Bye.
If you're a lineman in charge of keeping the lights on, Granger understands that you go to great lengths and sometimes heights to ensure the power is always flowing, which is why you can count on Granger for professional-grade products and next-day delivery, so you have everything you need to get the job done. Call 1-800-GRANGER, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.